Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're cracking open a truly monumental book.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
It's Ron Chernow's Pulitzer Prize-winning The House of Morgan, An American Banking Dynasty and the Rise of Modern Finance. And honestly, it's not just a history book. It feels more like, well, a revelation.
Indeed. Chernow, you know, he spent years digging into this dynasty. They were famously secretive, this Anglo-American powerhouse.
Right. Stretching all the way from like Victorian London to Wall Street skyscrapers.
Exactly. And what he found gives us this incredible insight into how modern capitalism, the system we live in now, was really shaped and shaped fundamentally by just four generations of this one family.
It's wild to think about a family operating from the mid-1800s right up to 1987 and the power they wielded. I mean, sometimes it eclipsed entire governments, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They weren't just, you know, watching history happen. They were making it.
So why is their story so significant for us today?
Well, think about this. They literally saved the United States Treasury from bankruptcy once, single-handedly.
Wow.
They basically orchestrated the birth of modern corporate America by consolidating huge industries.
Like pulling strings behind the scenes.
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
And for decades, they effectively acted as the de facto central bank for the U.S. This was all before the Federal Reserve even existed.
So like these unseen hands guiding the economic fate of, well, America and Europe.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, so our mission today then is to explore how this private bank got so powerful, what drove them, you know, their core beliefs.
And crucially, why their story, their legacy, still matters so much for understanding that ongoing tension, the one between private money and public good.
That's a big one today. All right, let's dive in. Let's unpack this incredible saga. So when we talk about the House of Morgan, the name that jumps out is J.P. Morgan, right? The legend.
Mm.
But the story, Chernow tells us, actually starts earlier with his father.
That's right. Junius Spencer Morgan. He wasn't born into finance aristocracy. He was a merchant from Connecticut. Actually quite quiet.
But ambitious.
Very. His big move was relocating to London in the 1850s. London was the financial center then.
The place to be.
Absolutely. Mm. He became a partner in a firm that eventually became J.S. Morgan & Co. And his real genius, it was seeing this connection.
What connection?
Between the huge conservative pools of capital in Europe and the almost desperate need for investment in America during its Gilded Age. America was industrializing like crazy.
Right, building railroads, factories.
Exactly. It needed cash, massive amounts. And Junius became the bridge, channeling European money into American enterprise.
And young Pierpont, the future JP, born 1837, he grew up watching this.
He absorbed it all. His father taught him banking wasn't just about numbers, about transactions. It was deeper.
Oh, so?
It was about building relationships that lasted, creating this aura of absolute reliability. That became the Morgan way.
Less about the quick buck, more about enduring trust.
Precisely. Reputation was everything.
And JP's own education.
Oh, very cosmopolitan. Schools in Switzerland, Germany. But his real education, that came from his father's London office.
We're learning the ropes directly.
Yeah. He learned that the real currency in banking wasn't just pounds or dollars, it was information, you know, knowing things others didn't. Deep relationships.
Mm.
And timing. Impeccable timing.
He also picked up that meticulousness from his father. And that dislike for competition?
A profound disdain for what he saw as destructive competition, yes. He saw it as wasteful, chaotic.
Okay, so Pierpont comes of age right around the American Civil War. Huge upheaval.
Immense chaos.
Yeah.
But for the Morgans, it was also, well, an opportunity.
Oh.
While everyone else saw instability, they saw financing needs.
Mm.
Massive ones. They arranged crucial loans for the Union cause.
An early sign of their strategic thinking.
And it taught Pierpont a vital lesson. Great fortunes aren't made by avoiding risk. They're made by understanding it, managing it better than anyone else.
So after the war, he sets up in New York.
Yes, because he understood something fundamental. Whoever controlled the financing of America's next big boom, the industrial expansion, would basically control America itself.
He saw where the power was shifting.
He saw the future and knew it ran on capital.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting, right? The 1870s, 1880s, this is J.P. Morgan's rise.
Absolutely. His transformation. Especially in railroad financing. He didn't just lend money. He invented something called Morganization.
Morganization? What's that?
It was interventionist. He'd step in, restructure entire railroad companies, sometimes entire industries. He put his own guys on the boards, dictate strategy.
What? Just for control?
Partly control, yes, but mainly to impose order. To end those destructive rate wars and chaotic practices he hated, he saw competition as wasteful.
So his solution was consolidation.
Ruthless consolidation.
Yeah.
Bring competing companies together, sometimes whether they liked it or not, into massive trusts.
And this is how giants like GE and AT&T got formed.
He orchestrated their creation, yes. And famously, U.S. Steel, the world's first billion-dollar corporation. It just completely redefined the scale of business.
But the moment that really cemented his power, 1895, the U.S. Treasury crisis.
Right. This was huge. The U.S. government was running out of gold. The whole financial system was teetering because of the gold standard.
And President Cleveland, he had no options.
He turned to Morgan. There was this incredibly dramatic meeting at the White House.
And Morgan saved the day.
He arranged a massive gold loan, yes, $65 million. Mm. And this is key. It was on his terms. Like, the U.S. government was just another client needing restructuring.
Wow. So he wasn't just a banker anymore.
Exactly. This is when he became that shadow central banker. It raised massive questions even then about how much power one private citizen should have. He'd essentially privatized America's financial sovereignty just for a moment.
But that power, it must have created fear, resentment.
It absolutely bred fear and led to intense scrutiny. But his perhaps crowning achievement came later. During the panic of 1907.
Another crisis.
A huge one. The whole financial system was on the verge of collapse. And again, there was no Federal Reserve, no government body to stop it.
So, Morgan again.
Morgan again. He was 70 years old. He personally took charge, locked the country's top bankers in his private library.
Locks them in? Seriously?
Yep. Until they agreed on a plan, pooled their resources, and stabilized the markets. It was extraordinary. He saved the system.
That just proved the point, didn't it?
It did. It starkly revealed how dangerously dependent the entire U.S. economy was on this one man's judgment and resources.
And then that led to?
Directly to the Pujo Committee hearings in 1912. A major public investigation. Congress wanted to know about this money trust.
The idea that Morgan and a few others controlled everything.
Precisely. The public was scared. He faced really humiliating questions. People say it broke his spirit.
And he died soon after.
In 1913, just months before the Federal Reserve Act was passed, creating the institution designed to take over the very roles he'd been playing informally. The irony.
It's stark, but the dynasty didn't end there. His son, Jack, took over.
Jack Morgan, yes. And he faced maybe an even bigger challenge, World War I.
How were they involved?
J.P. Morgan & Co. became the main financial agent for Britain and France in America. They arranged enormous loans to fund the Allied war effort.
Which must have been hugely profitable.
Immense profits, yes.
Yeah.
But also immense controversy. It tied America deeper into the European conflict and even led to a terrorist attack on their Wall Street headquarters.
So the power continued, but so did the controversy. What about the final big challenge? The New Deal.
Ah, yes. The Great Depression changed everything. The Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 was a direct response to the crash.
What did it do?
It forced the breakup of the House of Morgan. It mandated this fundamental split between commercial banking, you know, taking deposits, making loans, and investment banking advising companies, underwriting stocks.
Why split?
The idea was to prevent banks from using depositors' money for risky Wall Street speculation, which many blame for the crash.
So the end of the House of Morgan.
Not exactly the end, but a radical transformation. Yeah. They had to choose. They adapted. They created Morgan Stanley, a new firm dedicated to investment banking, carrying on that advisory tradition. And the original J.P. Morgan & Co. continued as a commercial bank. Two separate entities born from the old house.
So looking back at their peak, those big moments, 1895, U.S. Steel, 1907, they really did reshape finance, didn't they?
Fundamentally. They created templates, established practices. Morganization became a model for restructuring. The modern investment bank owes a lot to them.
And culturally, beyond finance.
Well, J.P. Morgan's massive art collection, his philanthropy, it set a standard for how the super rich should engage with culture. And their emphasis on character, discretion, that shaped business culture too.
But their power also directly led to reforms like the Fed.
Exactly. Their very success created the need for institutions to limit that kind of concentrated private power. It's a fascinating legacy.
Okay, we've traced the history, the rise, the struggles, the achievements, but let's dig into the why. What was really driving them? What was the core philosophy of the House of Morgan?
It was very distinct. You could call it an aristocratic philosophy, really, rooted in this deep sense of duty, almost nobility and discretion.
So finance wasn't just about making money.
For them, no. It was a calling. It demanded impeccable character, sound judgment. The idea that a gentleman's word was his bond, that was central. Reputation for them was genuinely more valuable than profit.
Which seems almost quaint today, but clearly worked for them. And that view on competition, that it was wasteful.
Yes, they truly believe that. Their big consolidations creating trusts like U.S. Steel. They didn't see it as building monopolies, though many critics certainly did.
How did they see it?
As bringing order, rationality, efficiency, getting rid of the chaos and waste of cutthroat competition. It had shades of social Darwinism, you know, survival of the fittest, most efficient structure guided by them.
There was also this paternalistic angle, wasn't there?
Very much so. J.P. Morgan saw himself almost as a steward, a guardian of America's economic destiny. He believed his immense power came with immense responsibilities.
Which justified him acting like a central banker when needed.
In his mind, yes. He felt he had to step in for the good of the country, even if it meant overriding democratic processes or public opinion.
And they weren't just after profit. They wanted respectability.
Oh, absolutely. JP's huge art collection, his yachts, his lifestyle. It wasn't just indulgence. It was strategic, a way to transform that new money into the established respectability of old money.
Aligning themselves with the elites.
Exactly. And they also framed their work, financing America's growth, as patriotic. They believed deeply in American exceptionalism and saw themselves as crucial players in building that exceptional nation.
How did this philosophy shape how they handled problems like the panics or the investigations?
It dictated their response. Maintain dignity, maintain composure, rely on your superior resources, your network, your relationships, never show panic.
Like Morgan in 1907.
Precisely. He didn't flinch. He methodically gathered the resources, exerted his will, commanded action. Even during those brutal Peugeot hearings, he kept this stoic dignity. He understood his ultimate asset, the thing they couldn't truly touch, was his reputation.
Okay, the journey of the House of Morgan is packed with these dramatic moments. Let's zero in on three really pivotal turning points, the ones that truly show their power, their impact, and maybe the problems they raise.
Right. Three moments that really shifted the ground. First, let's go back to the 1895 Treasury rescue. We talked about it, but the key takeaway here is Morgan becoming essentially a financial sovereign.
More than just a banker lending money.
Much more. It wasn't just a loan. It was Morgan dictating terms to the U.S. government. It starkly revealed that in a crisis, private capital could hold more sway than public authority.
And the implication.
That America's financial stability could hinge on one private individual's decisions and resources. It exposed a fundamental vulnerability in the system. That's why it directly fueled calls for a public central bank, the Fed.
Okay. Pivotal point number one, the banker becomes sovereign. What's number two?
Number two has to be the creation of U.S. Steel in 1901. This was, you could argue, the absolute peak of Morgan's power and his philosophy in action. Industrial consolidation as an art form.
Bringing all those steel companies together.
Into the world's first billion-dollar corporation. Controlling something like 60% of U.S. steel production. It wasn't just about being big. It was about eliminating competition through sheer overwhelming scale, imposing his vision of order.
But this had consequences.
Huge consequences. This unprecedented concentration of power genuinely alarmed the public. It became the poster child for the money trust and really ignited the antitrust movement. It turned public opinion sharply against him.
So the peak of his power also sowed the seeds of its limitations.
Exactly. Okay. Third turning point, the panic of 1907. We can call this playing central banker without portfolio.
Stepping in where the government couldn't.
Or wouldn't, or didn't have the mechanism to. The financial system was collapsing, and Morgan, at 70, literally orchestrated the rescue from his library.
Locking the doors.
Locking the doors. It was incredibly decisive, and it worked. It saved the system. But
it hammered home that dangerous dependence again.
Absolutely. It was the most dramatic illustration possible that America's entire economic stability rested on the shoulders of one private citizen. It made the case for the Federal Reserve undeniable. The system needed a public institution, not just a private savior.
Those three moments, they really capture the arc, don't they? The power, the ambition, the impact, and ultimately the backlash.
You really do. Each one shows a different facet of Morgan's influence and the questions it raised for America.
You know, this story, it's about vast wealth and global finance, but digging into it, there are some surprisingly human, relatable lessons that resonate even now.
I think so too. What stands out first for me is this core idea, character as ultimate currency.
Morgan's famous quote comes to mind.
Right. A man I do not trust could not get money from me on all the bonds in Christendom.
Yeah.
In a time before, you know, instant credit checks, reputation was everything.
And that feels timeless.
It really does. In any field, finance, business, even just life, your integrity, your reputation, that's arguably your most valuable asset in the long run.
Another thing is the power of long-term thinking. They weren't just flipping stocks or chasing quarterly results.
Not at all. The Morgans played the long game, patiently building industries, cultivating relationships that lasted decades.
Right.
That created advantages that were really hard to replicate.
Which is a useful reminder in our, let's face it, pretty short-term focused world.
Definitely. It suggests that the biggest successes often need the longest timelines, the most patience.
What about dealing with change? They faced huge disruption, like Glass-Steagall.
Right, and that points to adaptation while maintaining core values. They didn't just fold when the rules changed dramatically.
They split the firm, created Morgan Stanley.
Exactly. They reshaped the business model, adapted to the new reality, but they tried to hold on to those core Morgan principles. Quality, discretion, client focus. That flexibility, that ability to change without losing your core identity, that's vital for navigating disruption anywhere.
There's also the whole question of the responsibility of power.
Huge lesson there. The Morgans, whatever you think of their methods, seem to understand that their immense power came with responsibilities. J.P. Morgan clearly felt a duty, albeit a self-appointed one, to stabilize the system.
But it also showed the limits of that, right?
Absolutely. It showed how private power could serve public ends sometimes. But it also led directly to the conclusion that in a democracy, such power needs public accountability, needs institutional checks. That tension is incredibly relevant today with, say, big tech or modern finance.
And finally, there's something quite poignant, isn't there?
You mean the loneliness of ultimate financial power?
Yeah. Imagine being that person. The one everyone turns to in a crisis, the one whose decisions affect millions, but who can you actually talk to? Who really understands?
It's profound isolation. J.P. Morgan's position really set him apart. There's a real human cost, almost a tragic dimension, to wielding that kind of immense, almost undemocratic influence. It adds another layer to the story beyond just money and power.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's try to distill it down. Three powerful takeaways from this epic story of the House of Morgan.
Okay, three key insights. First, maybe an emotional insight. The burden of undemocratic power.
Go on.
The story really reveals the deep isolation, the personal weight that comes with having that kind of ultimate, unchecked financial authority. When Morgan said, "I owe the public nothing," maybe it wasn't just arrogance.
What else could it be?
Perhaps a reflection of knowing his position was fundamentally outside normal relationships, outside democratic accountability. He and his successors lived in this rarefied air, making decisions impacting millions, but trusting few, with no real framework to share that burden. It helps you feel the personal cost, the loneliness behind the power.
That adds a lot of depth. Okay, what about an intellectual takeaway?
For that, I'd say, capitalism as an evolving system, shaped by necessity and response. The Morgans' real genius wasn't just making money, it was inventing new ways of organizing the economy.
Like relationship banking, consolidation.
Exactly. They created structures that solved real problems of the time, mobilizing capital, stabilizing markets. But understanding how they built those systems, and crucially, why that concentrated power eventually demanded public oversight, the Fed, Glass-Steagall shows us something vital.
Which is?
That capitalism isn't fixed. It's dynamic. It's a constantly evolving set of institutions and rules, shaped by historical crises, human choices, and the need for legitimacy. The market is never truly free. It's always structured.
That's a powerful framework. Okay, finally, a universal insight, something practical we can all take away.
I think it comes back to this. Reputation is the unassailable asset for sustainable influence. Through their entire arc rise, dominance, transformation, the Morgans showed that character and credibility were ultimately more valuable than any deal or asset.
Their power rested on trust.
Completely. Their influence depended on their word being seen as their bond, and public trust eroding, fueled by those money trust fears, was key to the limits eventually placed upon them.
So that less
it transcends finance. In any field, In this age of instant communication where reputations can be made or destroyed overnight, the Morgan focus on fundamental character, on integrity over mere cleverness. That feels like a truly timeless guide for building anything meant to last.
Character, evolution, and the burden of power. Heavy stuff, but fascinating.
An incredible story with lessons that still echo loudly today.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.